These lectures are part of the Great Courses. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website at thegreatcourses.com and imagine how much you can learn if you spend just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the Great Courses and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled Espionage and Covert Operations, A Global History. The lecturer is Vaius Gabriel Lulevicius. Dr. Lulevicius is the Lindsay Young Professor of History and Director of the Center for the Study of War and Society at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. He has won numerous awards for his teaching and scholarship. Among these are the University of Tennessee's Excellence in Teaching Award and a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship. Lecture 1, Introducing the Secret World.
Hello, my name is Vaius Lulevicius. Welcome to this course on espionage and covert operations, which opens the door to the shadowy world of spying and secret actions, a world of desperate and daring characters, devious plans, great successes and resounding failures, and many lessons that have immediacy for us today in our own complex world. Now, this is not a how-to course in do-it-yourself spying. Rather, we will together look at the historical record to see what espionage really is, what it is capable of, and what place it has occupied in society and consciousness from ancient times to the present day. We will look at not only individual spies themselves and the devious and dangerous things they got up to, but also at how society has thought about spying, how it has judged it. Is a spy a traitorous and filthy creature? Or a hero or heroine, someone who functions as the first line of defense for a society that is perhaps in the hour of its greatest peril? In a word, we will also examine the myth of the spy, the way in which different cultures around the world and through history have told stories about espionage and secret operations. A recurring theme we will investigate is periodic spy panics, when a society is seized by the overwhelming fear that spies are among us. You can tell a lot about a society by what it fears, and we'll exploit this opportunity to the fullest. Our course also looks at espionage and covert operations together. Covert operations, like the raid that tracked down Osama bin Laden in 2011 after many years of pursuit, even when they're not conducted by spies, but rather by special forces or elite military units, are part of the world of clandestine hidden policy behind the scenes, away from public view, which also includes espionage and counterintelligence. This has aptly been called the secret world, the history behind open and public history. And it is that arena that we want to investigate. Here are some scenes from the history of the secret world that we will focus on in our coming lectures. The year is 827. The place is Egypt. And a small band of Venetian merchants creep through the narrow streets of Alexandria. They're on a special mission of great importance, and it's not an honest one. They are here to steal the relics of St. Mark. If they can get them, St. Mark's earthly remains will be a great prize, both spiritually and economically. Having the relics of St. Mark in their hometown, the serene city of Venice, will put the stamp of spiritual greatness on what is already a formidable trading empire, and will attract more pilgrims and worshippers with their money to Venice as well. Will the Venetian merchants be able to seize the relics? How will they be able to smuggle these treasures out and across the Mediterranean back to Venice? We will see. Imagine now that you've been invited to a fine, elegant dinner one evening while the American Civil War is raging. You dine at the White House of the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia, hosted by the Confederate President, Jefferson Davis, who has also invited generals of the rebel armies. By flickering candlelight, the dinner conversation turns to the battle plans. All pay attention to those plans, where each army will move, where attacks will next take place. But no one seems to be paying attention to an African-American woman who is serving at the table. No one seems to notice how she is carefully listening and remembering key details to pass along to Union spies. This African-American woman is Mary Elizabeth Bowser, a spy in the very household of the Confederacy's first family. The culture of slavery had taught the generals and leaders of the Confederacy to regard slaves as not fully human, and it was this very racist convention that Bowser was able to turn against the Confederacy in her spying. We'll learn about her remarkable adventure. Or consider the most famous of all women spies, Mata Hari. The exotic dancer turned spy was a legend in the First World War. But what we see now is no scene of glamour or intrigue. Instead, on an early October morning in 1917, Mata Hari is taken by French soldiers and put before a firing squad of 12 riflemen. Mata Hari refuses a blindfold and stares calmly ahead. But is she guilty? Is she innocent? Whom had she betrayed? Or is she a convenient scapegoat for the failures of French generals? Why will her legend grow and grow even after Mata Hari's ignominious execution? We will follow her tragic life to its end and beyond into the realm of mythic immortality. And finally, a case from our own times. Newspapers report that in early 2011, a suspected spy was captured in the desert hinterlands of Saudi Arabia. The spy bore the identification code R65. The spy was also carrying a global positioning system transmitter. The spy had beady eyes, sharp claws, and feathers. R65 was actually a vulture. Locals involved in the capture of R65 said that they believed the bird was part of a Zionist plot, that in fact it was a trained spy of Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service. For their part, Israeli authorities explained that the bird had been tagged as part of a multi-year study of migratory patterns. However, the bizarre rumor still went viral on the internet, a further example of how anxieties about spying speak volumes about politics and society. Before we can plunge into these marvelous and mysterious stories and their lessons, we need to first define some of the terms that we'll be encountering over and over again in these lectures. It's almost as if espionage has its own secret language. And in fact, that's just as it should be in the secret world. First, what is espionage? That's a fancy word for the activity of a spy. The word spy comes from Old Germanic roots, from the word spähen in German, for looking, seeing, tracking, or scouting. A spy, thus, is someone who observes, to gain intelligence for advantage. Espionage, thus, refers to the collecting of secret information by secret means, most often illegally, and is also called by the wider and more neutral-sounding term intelligence. What is meant by covert operations, sometimes also called special operations? This signifies another secret undertaking, clandestine-like espionage, but not aiming at collection of information. Instead, it is an action intended to bring about some result, but not openly. It may involve the desire to maintain plausible deniability, keeping the identity of the actor hidden. Examples of this in particular that we'll see later in our course can involve assassination attempts. Here let me mention as a stunning example the murder by poisoned umbrella of a Bulgarian dissident in London in 1978. In our own times, in 2010, A computer worm was directed at sabotaging Iranian nuclear facilities, and its author is still disputed to this day. Or the American launching of the Bay of Pigs invasion in the Cold War, which absurdly enough was supposed to be plausible deniability and the United States' role not obvious. Espionage and covert operations are not identical. They require often different skill sets. But they can also often work in tandem and are related ultimately by being integral parts of what we call the secret world. Intelligence gathering comes in two varieties, known in the bureaucratic jargon as HUMINT for human intelligence and SIGINT for signals intelligence. HUMINT means the use of human agents to collect the information. What the motivations of such a human agent might be, we'll come to shortly. HUMINT has been with us from the beginning of time. Since the first band of humans observed another band of their fellows off in the distance and wondered what they were up to. In HUMINT, the human element obviously is at the fore. The cunning, subtlety, subterfuge, improvisation, quick thinking, and dissimulation, a fancy word for lying, which humans are capable of. By contrast, SIGINT is a newer form of intelligence gathering. It relies on technical means to crack the communications stream of a targeted group. As we shall see in our course, it involves the interception of secret messages, the breaking of codes that encrypt or hide the intended message, the use of code machines like the German Enigma process in World War II, or cyber warfare in our own times. In our own times, indeed, SIGINT has acquired a new subcategory, ELINT, or electronic intelligence, which we will address towards the close of our course. So, there's largely HUMINT and SIGINT. And I suppose, if you're inclined to believe that a vulture could be a spy in the Middle East, perhaps also BIRDINT, or not. If these are the kinds of intelligence, what then is meant by counterintelligence? Counterintelligence signifies those efforts to frustrate the intelligence gathering of the opposing side, whoever that might be. It could involve the kinds of episodes we will see in our course that include the capturing of an enemy spy, the infiltration of the enemy intelligence service with a spy of one's own, or the deliberate spreading of false information to the enemy to confuse and misdirect. Such false information is known by the name of disinformation, untrue information. An allied concept is that of a provocation, whereby the enemy is lured into doing something unintentionally revealing or compromising, which will show the enemy in the very worst light for all the world to see. The only way to effectively guard against being fooled by disinformation or provocations is for an agency to have multiple confirmations of a report. Built-in redundancy is a key because it gives more certainty in this uncertain world. An agent is the name given to a spy for one's own side. Notice how agent sounds official, proper, respectable, someone fulfilling a legitimate function, a legitimate role. While by contrast, spy still carries with it the association of something dirty and disreputable, illegitimate, morally questionable in the highest degree. And so it's been joked, our side has agents, the other side has spies. In this case, then, what is meant by the term double agent? A double agent is one who pretends to be an agent for one side, but actually is secretly spying for the enemy. Perfectly placed, for instance, to pass along disinformation. Then there are triple agents, who pretend to be agents for one side, while also pretending to be secretly spying for the enemy, while in fact they are spying for the side whose agent they are from the outset pretending to be. How confusing! It is no wonder, then, that this realm was described by a counterintelligence expert, whom we'll meet in a later lecture, as a wilderness of mirrors, where the truth is never what it seems, and lies about lies proliferate until everyone has lost their sense of direction. So-called moles and sleepers are other kinds of agents. Moles are sent to burrow into the structures of the targeted power over a long period and can work their way up to positions that are astonishingly high. we'll see one amazing case of this in the most successful Cold War spy, who was in fact a Soviet spy while holding positions high up in British intelligence. Sleepers are agents who are sent to infiltrate a targeted enemy over the very long haul, and whose task is not to be constantly active, but to wait or sleep until in some decisive hour they are activated for a mission. For example, in 2010, 10 Russian nationals were arrested in the United States by the FBI as part of a ring of illegal spies, and foremost among them was the red-haired and glamorous young spy Anna Chapman. Her maiden name, in fact, was Kushchenko, who returned to Russia and was a celebrity spy afterwards. A problem with sleepers is that many of them actually tend to really go to sleep, adjusting too well to their surrounding society, and it's difficult to activate them for their intended tasks. Agents of all kinds have superiors who direct them, telling them what intelligence to seek, setting up meetings, and rewarding them for their services. These superiors are called handlers, or especially in the case of American convention, case officers. All these definitions are helpful, but they leave the bigger questions that arise for anyone who thinks about espionage or covert operations. For most of us, even the thought of living a life of subterfuge and danger starts doubts within us. How long would we last? When would the pressure of this role cause our facade to break? So we want to pose this question: what kind of person would become a spy? What is the psychology behind a spy? What are the motives of spies or intelligence professionals? Because human beings are complex, so too, obviously, are the motives behind espionage. It could just be for money. It could be for reasons of the ego, believing oneself unappreciated and wanting to play this special secret role. In the case of spies betraying their own country, the motive may be resentment as a deep personal psychological factor, resentment against one's class, one's schooling, parents, or society. The motives can also include, how shall we put this gently, delusions, a desire for adventure, or simply a misunderstanding of what espionage is really like. As we shall see repeatedly, the reality of spying differs markedly from the fantasy world of film and some fiction. Like the old adage about war, real espionage is most often made up of vast stretches of boredom punctuated by sharp moments of fear. Some spies are motivated by the threat of blackmail. That's to say, they're threatened with consequences if they don't go along. But these are often very unpredictable agents because they're prone to try to turn against those who are threatening them. Then there is another, and quite volatile motive, that we shall trace in some special cases in our course, the motive of spying for ideological reasons, because of true faith and devotion to an ideology. An ideology is not just a set of theories. It's a system of thought that explains how the world works and should work. Ideologies have included liberalism and democracy, communism, fascism, and Nazism. We will see these ideologies at work in our lectures, and we will explore a paradox. Ideologically motivated agents are at the same time both the most reliable and potentially the most undependable agents. How can this be? An ideologically motivated agent might volunteer for espionage with no pressure or inducement necessary. An ideologically motivated agent might even refuse to be paid so as not to sully the purity of his or her motives and faith. Such an agent is capable of running the most harrowing risks and, if needed, sacrifice his or her own life, and maybe the lives of others, because he or she believes in the transcendent worth of the cause. However, ironically, it's exactly this that makes an ideological agent infuriating to handlers. A true believer might act independently, might refuse orders if they seem to violate the one true faith, might be inflexible and fanatic when what's needed in that moment is flexibility and pragmatism. It is for this reason that some handlers, as we shall see, have insisted on paying agents who otherwise would spy for free. It makes the agent beholden to the handler in ways that are more practical than fervent belief. How does one become an agent? An old maxim is that if you have to ask to be an agent, you won't be. Don't call us, we'll call you. But in fact, as we'll see in some lectures, some agents do volunteer. Others, by contrast, are pressured or blackmailed into the role. However they come to this role, they are then given training. They are instructed in what is called tradecraft, that set of conventions of communicating with handlers, how to use codes, how to avoid being followed. We will see in our course how over time the business of espionage has become more elaborate and professionalized. But we will also see that in the realm of the human agent, attempts to turn espionage into a rigorous science with rigid rules and inflexible drills have ended in disaster. That's because some of the human traits so key to effective espionage cannot easily be taught. These include quick understanding, the ability to think oneself into a role and stay in character, and finally, sneakiness, plain and simple. On the other hand, tradecraft involves often very simple and old maxims or rules that are taken from hard-won experience in espionage. Let me give some examples, and in later lectures, we'll be able to note good tradecraft as well as some of the disasters that can follow from breaking its guidelines. First, information must be verified. A single source can all too easily mislead or be mistaken, because that gives confidence. In a spying organization, similarly, it's best to keep individual spies separate from one another, so that they interact with their handler, but otherwise are in contact with as few other members of the ring or network as possible. In a word, it is best to compartmentalize. This will make it harder for the ring to be broken or rolled up by enemies if a single spy is caught. Another maxim of tradecraft is that one of the most dangerous moments for an agent who is in place is when that agent has to send communications back to his or her handlers. At that point, they expose themselves and are vulnerable. This has led to techniques of tradecraft for safer communication, like the so-called brush pass, in which a seemingly trivial and accidental meeting in a public place covers the passing of documents or information. One agent drops a newspaper, another agent picks it up. Words don't pass, but information or documents have been exchanged. More effective still is the so-called dead drop. This involves leaving a message in a prearranged place, like behind a radiator in an apartment building, under a bridge, or hidden in a discarded soda can along a road, to be picked up later by the handler so that the individuals never actually meet. But there are possibilities for even a dead drop going awry if the dead drop is disturbed by someone who doesn't know what's involved. The tradecraft of a handler or a case officer is also tremendously demanding and complicated, just in terms of personnel management. Agents and spies need to be recruited. Very often, however, the most important spies will volunteer themselves. Even more important, productive agents need to be cultivated, encouraged, and motivated. Often, spies also need to be reassured that measures are being taken to help them escape if their cover is blown. It has been said, with some justice, that good tradecraft keeps espionage routine and boring, which is good, because excitement actually means that something has gone terribly wrong. A final point to keep in mind is that even at the end of the day, when the spy has delivered the information that has been sought, whether it's military, political, or economic information, that alone does not ensure that the covert operation will have been an ultimate success. Because information is but one part of what goes into policy. And making policy decisions is the province not of spies, but of the political leaders who employ them. Will the leadership believe the information? Will they interpret its meaning and implications correctly? Or will they perhaps disregard valuable information? We will see in this course instances of intelligence disasters, such as Stalin's dogged insistence that there was no way that his associate Hitler would invade the Soviet Union, as he insisted until the very day when the Nazis did invade in 1941, in spite of having good intelligence warning him of this fact beforehand. Our course will also speak to significant debates in scholarship on espionage and covert operations, and I would just like to highlight those debates now from the very beginning. First, one debate asks the challenging question, how important has spying really been historically? Is it really the secret history behind history, as is sometimes claimed? Given the way in which popular accounts of espionage and covert operations make vast claims for the impact that such activity has had, how can we be sure that this is not just idle boasting, self-important self-promotion? In a word, how decisive is intelligence? The brilliant British military historian John Keegan has made a strong skeptical argument in his volume Intelligence in War. Keegan insists, after giving a series of critical case studies, that intelligence is a factor among others in war, but that at the end of the day, it is brute force and decision on the battlefield, not the scuffling in the shadows, that really determines victory. Keegan's thesis mostly concerns intelligence in war, which is not the only kind of intelligence gathering. We'll see in this course how spying in peacetime has been crucial as well. By the end of this course, I hope that you will have your own considered opinion in this debate and a wealth of details to support your own argument, whatever it might be. Another theme we will pursue in this course is how the practice of espionage has evolved over time in a process of professionalization. Now, this is not meant to put down amateurs, but to note that over time, espionage has been elaborated, tradecraft lessons have been learned, experiences have been registered, and espionage has been turned into a business involving training, regular procedure, centralized control, and a standardized method. A third debate we will follow concerns a question of tremendous import for our own times. What is the appropriate role of spying or secrecy in a democracy? Is there any role for spying and secrets in an open society? Is perfect transparency possible? Is it desirable? As we will note, especially in the context of the Cold War, democracies and open societies are much easier for spies to operate in than in closed authoritarian societies. So the question presents itself, how can democracies defend themselves? The existential stakes here are clear. Finally, the overall theme of this course might best be described as the myth of the spy. That is, the place of the spy and espionage and covert operations in society and culture. In a word, why do spies fascinate us? To get a grip on this question, we will track in our lectures over the centuries how spies have been understood in different ways. Sometimes they've been seen as traitors, to be shot when captured. At other times, as glamorous heroes, ideal figures embodying the best virtues of the society they seek to defend. Spies have been feared or admired. Why? Of particular interest to us will be to look closely at repeated spy panics. Why would a society be suddenly seized by the fear that it has been infiltrated? What does this tell us about the social context of the spy? As we will see, the spy has been a part of government from ancient times. The open and public business of governing has always had a secret side as well. And this is actually encoded in our language, or used to be. Think of the title for someone who works in an office, originally a government office, secretary. Today, of course, we use the far blander term of administrative assistant or the like. But secretary meant originally someone who deals with confidential, secret things, from the Latin secretum, that is, something set apart. Now, isn't that a far more auspicious and important sounding title than administrative assistant? We will see in this course how a secretary to Queen Elizabeth, Mr. Secretary Sir Francis Walsingham, first embodied the link between government and the secret world of espionage and covert operations. Here is at least part of the answer to the question of why spies fascinate us. Their stories from the secret world seem to offer us a hint of the fuller, bigger picture of how world politics actually works and has worked. And that is really the launching premise of this course. For a full comprehension of the forces at work in international politics, we must understand the intriguing secret role of espionage and the shadowy world of covert operations. Let me add one caveat, perhaps obvious. By its very nature, the history of espionage had episodes or details that we will not fully know at a given time, as secrets have been kept. Sometimes the full story emerges only much later. A case like this, which we'll discuss in later lectures, involves the intercepts of Soviet secret communications of the 1930s by American authorities, known as the Venona intercepts, whose existence was only made public in the 1990s, decades afterwards. Thus, what we knew about Soviet atomic spies, for instance, was completely revolutionized half a century after the fact. When we still do not know crucial dimensions of some story, I will note them in the course. I also need to mention a wonderful resource for more insight into espionage and the chance to see firsthand some of the technology associated with modern spying. This is the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., opened in 2002. I recommend it highly. This will be a fascinating undertaking. And to start it properly, we will go all the way back to examine this topic from its beginnings, the time of ancient espionage, in our next lecture.